This is the program, Masterpieces of World Literature, hosted by Dr. Susan Anderson, and this is her 4th of July special. Susan will be delving into the spirit of America's favorite holiday celebration to put into perspective the intentions of America's architects and what has developed during the past almost 250 years. Susan will add a second element to this scenario by talking about the importance of intelligent change and the advent of Maharshi's complementary government. Susan, what is this complementary government?
The title of the show is Celebrating the Inauguration of the U.S. Peace Government, Fulfilling the American Quest for Self-Government. On July 2, 2003, His Excellency Dr. John Hagelin, Minister of Science and Technology of the Global Country of World Peace, will announce a peace government to be a complementary government for the U.S. government in Washington, D.C. This complementary government does not replace the current government, as he will explain in the press conference, because it is a government of unity consciousness that will support the country by aligning it with natural law. And how it will do this, we'll talk a little bit at the end of the program, and he will explain in detail. This is not a new idea for the United States, as this program will explore. We'll look at the theme of self-referral as the basis of both the American Constitution and nature's Constitution. During this hour, we'll read excerpts from four American writers who spoke of the true potential of democracy as self-government: Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, Thoreau's essay Resistance to Civil Government, and Whitman's essay Democratic Vistas. We'll also hear statements from Maharshi's Absolute Theory of Government and Perfection in Administration. But first, an overview. America was treated as an experiment by its European settlers. Civilization in the Old World, they felt, had become corrupt, divorced from God's grace and natural law. In the New World, the remedy was a government emphasizing process over fixed and faulty tradition. The principles of tolerance, self-reliance, freedom to try new things, along with rigorous soul-searching and feedback, promised a just system that would always be open to revision in case any mistake cropped up. Change was built in. But there was another underlying theme as well. America was the promised land, the golden age, the earthly paradise, one nation under God, a country wedded to natural law. Now, this is a paradox, change within perfection. And there was another paradox. It would be a country tolerant of differences, but also working together as one whole, e pluribus unum. These major principles, ongoing purification, and the unity of differences, are very noble ideas, but they also happen to be principles of nature. Nature purifies itself in ongoing evolution, and yet change is never random. Nature coordinates the evolution of everything in a grand unity. Maharshi says of nature's government, quote, "In this phenomenon of perfect administration, all the diversified expressions of singularity spontaneously maintain connectedness with their source." This is from the Absolute Theory of Government. Therefore, nature is a unity, a wholeness within itself. And Maharshi describes this wholeness as invincible. Quote, "It is the self-referral activity of natural law that is responsible for absolute order in creation. That self-referral activity cannot be hampered from outside." The founders of the United States government attempted in 1776 to put these advanced principles into the Constitution. There would even be checks and balances to maintain progress, just as in nature. Jefferson's brilliant Declaration of Independence says, as we all have memorized in school, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Jefferson says, basically, it is the natural right of every individual to exist and to evolve without restraint, and that government does not originate in external control, but in internal self-government. It is based on truth, self-evident truth, available to the reason of everyone. Government is not about power, it is about truth. We can't rely on decisions of the people unless they are rooted in reason. Reason in the 18th century meant the transcendent truth of natural law. The rationale for breaking away from Great Britain, Jefferson says in the Declaration, is that it is violating natural law. America, on the other hand, declares itself to be on the side of, quote, "the laws of nature and nature's God," as Jefferson words it. The way Maharshi describes this idea in the Absolute Theory of Government is as follows, quote, "Absolute government is located in the field of self-referral pure intelligence, in the field of pure wakefulness, pure knowingness," unquote. In other words, the absolute government that governs the universe is also within us. So from the beginning, American government has tried to model itself on and felt it was being upheld by the government of nature. The founders also realized that the national government could only be continued in a just manner by individuals who were reasonable, in tune with the universal truth of nature rather than personal whim. Jefferson said the citizens would have to be properly educated. But, as the history of the Constitutional Convention shows, it was the human political process, after all, that we've grown used to, a group of men disagreeing but trying to patch together consensus, under pressures and compromises so severe that from the beginning they were forced to allow slavery to continue. A crack in the cornerstone of American justice that would almost end the Union. The Constitution was a brilliant document under the circumstances, but full of limitations. Jefferson worried about this, saying, quote, "Permitting one half the citizens thus to trample on the rights of the other transforms those into despots and these into enemies, destroys the morals of the one part and the patriotism of the other. I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." So even at this time, Jefferson makes a distinction between God's justice and the less than perfect human justice of the Constitution. As Jefferson foresaw, this fundamental weakness exploded, as it was bound to do, in a civil war. President Lincoln saw the civil war as a karmic wound for the country, but one that could heal because of something transcendent and unifying in the people themselves. It's what he called the mystic chords of memory, and, quote, the better angels of our nature in his first inaugural address. There is something greater, more universal, called the popular will, or that collective consciousness bigger than any individual or party. It is the ultimate wisdom in the people, the real checks and balances beyond the machinery of government. This larger will was purer than historical circumstance, so we had only to return to that in our own memories to get back on the track of justice. Historians speak of Lincoln's stunning coup and refounding of America at Gettysburg. And again, another excerpt that we should all be familiar with, and we've all had to memorize at one point or another. Quote, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. This nation, under God, shall have a new birth in freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. How could a government of the people not perish from the earth? It was a new covenant made in 1863, again, hopefully counting on the self-referral principle within the people to renew the nation. That memory of perfect government, deeply embedded in the people themselves, was invoked to bring the nation out of ruin. Lincoln's optimism about the popular will makes sense in light of Maharshi's description of a coherent and unified national consciousness. Quote, as national consciousness is the prime mover of the government, when the self-referral quality is lively in national consciousness, it will spontaneously render the functioning of the government on a par with the government of nature. And that's from his absolute theory of government. The deepest American thinkers have always pointed to a spiritual basis for America, something that does not get tainted by scandal or history or politics or personality. There is something behind government that sustains it, something that appeals to God's justice to correct human injustice. Such a thinker was Henry David Thoreau in his essay, Resistance to Civil Government, written in 1849. And this is a document that inspired Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, whose doctrine is not rebellion, as the title would suggest, but passive or benign resistance to wrong. It's not the idea of fighting government when it is wrong, but rising above it by enlivening the power of goodness within the individual. Thoreau went to jail for a day because he refused to pay tax to a government that supported slavery and war. In this essay, he makes it clear there are two governments, the expedient or man-made government and the higher government of absolute moral law that is not man-made. His allegiance to the absolute law of justice over the man-made government, he insists, does not undermine the government, but is the only way to infuse true justice into America. The individual is the unit of the country. When citizens embody and live absolute truth, they reach the ideal of self-government that Jefferson and Lincoln were talking about. These are the only citizens who hold up the nation by leavening the lump, as he puts it. Mere voting, he says, is gambling. So now I'm going to read some excerpts from that essay. resistance to civil government. I heartily accept the motto, that government is best which governs least. Carried out, it finally amounts to this, which I also believe. That government is best which governs not at all. And when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government which they will have. Government is at best but an expedient. The government itself, which is only the mode which the people have chosen to execute their will, is equally liable to be abused and perverted before the people can act through it. Witness the present Mexican War, the work of comparatively a few individuals using the standing government as their tool. For in the outset, the people would not have consented to this measure. Now, what he's referring to here is the fact that the war was criticized because President Polk declared war without congressional consent. And it was a war that was territorial in nature. And then he goes on to say, this American government, what is it but a tradition, though a recent one, endeavoring to transmit itself unimpaired to posterity, but each instant losing some of its integrity? This government never of itself furthered any enterprise. It does not keep the country free. It does not settle the West. It does not educate. The character inherent in the American people has done all that has been accomplished. Government is an expedient by which men would fain succeed in letting one another alone. I ask for not at once no government, but at once a better government. The practical reason a majority are permitted to rule is not because they are most likely to be in the right, but because they are physically the strongest. But a government in which the majority rule in all cases cannot be based on justice. Why has every man a conscience, then? The mass of men serve the state not as men, but as machines with their bodies. A very few, such as heroes, patriots, reformers, in the great sense, serve the state with their consciences also. It is not so important that many should be good as that there must be some absolute goodness somewhere, for that will leaven the whole lump. There are thousands who are, in opinion, opposed to slavery and to the war, yet who in effect do nothing to put an end to them. There are 999 patrons of virtue to one virtuous man. So in this point, what Thoreau is saying, I think, is that just merely voting for something, merely voting for some idea that seems to be good, is not really causing that thing to happen. It's an opinion. It's voting for your opinion. And here he is saying that 999 people who believe in virtue are nothing compared to one really virtuous person who is radiating that virtue. So this is the point, that the power of one truly good person is enough to influence the rest of the population, sort of his expression of the super radiance effect. One person, one absolutely good person will leaven the whole lump. And then he goes on to say, all voting is a sort of gaming. I cast my vote, perchance, as I think right, but I am not really vitally concerned that that right should prevail. I'm willing to leave it to the majority. Even voting for the right is doing nothing for it. The perception and performance of right changes things and relations. I think that it is enough to have God on one's side without waiting for the majority. Moreover, any man more right than his neighbor is a majority of one already. If 1,000, if 100, if 10 men whom I could name, if 10 honest men only, I, if one honest man in this state of Massachusetts, ceasing to hold slaves, were actually to withdraw from this co-partnership and be locked up in the county jail, it would be the abolition of slavery in America. For it matters not how small the beginning may seem to be. What is once done is done forever. Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. You must live within yourself and depend upon yourself. If a plant cannot live according to its nature, it dies. And so a man. Seen from a lower point of view, the Constitution, with all its faults, is very good. The law and the courts are very respectable. But the lawyer's truth is not truth with a capital T, but consistency or expediency. Truth is always in harmony with herself. They who know no purer sources of truth wisely stand by the Bible and the Constitution. But they who behold where it comes trickling into this lake or that pool continue their pilgrimage towards its fountainhead. In other words, he's saying the Bible and the Constitution may be some reflection of truth, and they may be very noble and very inspiring, but the wise man is he who goes towards the fountainhead. What is the source? What is the truth itself? The authority of government is still an impure one. Is a democracy such as we know it the last improvement possible in government? There will never be a really free and enlightened state until the state comes to recognize the individual as a higher and independent power from which all its own power and authority are derived. I please myself with imagining a state at last which can afford to be just to all men and to treat the individual with respect as a neighbor. Elsewhere, Thoreau says that nature is one and continuous everywhere, and yet the universe is a sphere whose center is wherever there is intelligence. The sun is not so central as a man. Now, what does he mean by that? And all of this emphasis on one individual as opposed to the majority. What he's talking about is quality, not quantity. And of course, he means not just one ordinary man, but a fully developed man, the cosmic kind that is a central switchboard for natural law, as Maharshi puts it. Like Whitman, Thoreau knew that democracy could not succeed unless the dull masses were leavened, as he puts it, by those who are more awake. And so he's saying the one just man is more right than a majority of men who are not fully awake. This would be a good place to stop for station identification, and we'll resume in a moment.
This is World Radio KHOE, broadcasting from the campus of Maharshi University of Management, and you're listening to Masterpieces of World Literature, the 4th of July special, hosted by Dr. Susan Anderson. The theme is self-referral, the basis of government, in which Susan is bringing out some principles of self-referral in government and the individual's role in government. Susan, please elaborate on the importance of self-referral in regards to the individual in society. Are you saying that if the individual is in a state of consciousness that maintains full awakening, then nature's government comes into operation automatically?
Yes, and this is a theme of many writers in American history, especially the Transcendentalists. They really understood this principle, Whitman, Thoreau, Emerson, that if we were going to have a fully developed democracy, we had to have fully developed citizens. In fact, that's even inherent in Jefferson's ideas. And the Transcendentalist writers were even clearer about this because they knew that a wide awake consciousness was the tool for drawing the support of nature to the country, and that the individual was the unit of the country. And so, as he's saying, as Thoreau says here in this essay, the government, we think of the government as doing everything. The government is protecting us. The government is making things better. And he says, you know, that's just a mechanical idea. The government is just some mechanism to carry out the will of the people. You have to go deeper than that to see the origin of the government in the individual. And what does that mean? Not just the individual's power, external power or will, but the consciousness of the people, something that Maharshi elaborates on as the collective consciousness. And that's, of course, also what Lincoln was bringing out, this idea of the popular will and a larger consciousness in the country itself, a more refined level of government, something that was not on the obvious level, but more removed, more powerful. That's why Lincoln thought this collective consciousness could repair itself. It, you know, government could be repaired. If it was just on the surface, it was looking pretty hopeless. But if we collected ourselves, if we went back to the collective self, then we could find where that source of government was. And the Transcendentalist writers are taking that even further, that the individual is the unit of collective consciousness. And so that individual, fully awake, was able to tap into the power of nature's self-referral because, of course, Maharshi explains that more fully, that the human nervous system is that glorified instrument of natural law that can perfectly and fully reflect the full functioning of nature's government. And so if that's enlivened in the individual, it's going to automatically be enlivened in the government, because then you'll have individuals either in the government acting from that level, or you will have the consciousness, that collective will that Lincoln was talking about, so full of that power, so reflecting that power from nature's government and so fully enlivened in these individuals that it will automatically show up in the government. And then human government can be more just, because he's saying, and even from the founders, they're realizing, they're doing their best to make the government as just as God's government, but not quite knowing how to do it. And Thoreau, and we're going to read Whitman in a minute, they understood the principles. I mean, they may not have known quite really how to implement it, but they really understood the principle.
This message is very timely in this day and age where a man-made government seems to affect almost every aspect of everyone's life. And we know that it can't be perfect because it's man-made. So Maharshi's timely bringing out this new complementary government is so sorely needed. And I guess you'll be covering that in your talk coming up.
Yes, and I think I'm really impressed with these writers, because they're quite clear that these two levels of government are existing. And I think it's been true all through history, is that very wise people and very virtuous people have always realized there were these different levels of government and have always appealed from the faulty human government to the more perfect level that was within their own awareness. And they felt that they could tap into this, that it was this virtue was not outside, it was within us. And so that's what they're appealing to and trying to bring that more to the mechanism of government itself. And so now we are going to turn to Whitman's essay, Democratic Vistas. Brilliant, brilliant essay. And only now, I think, have critics been analyzing this essay. It's been largely forgotten for Whitman's poetry. He says some of the same things in the essay that he does in his poetry, but people are turning to this essay now that was written in 1871, after the Civil War. And Whitman is predicting, okay, we've been through the Civil War, and he felt, he was quite realistic, he felt the country was not in very good shape at that time. But he is predicting, just as Lincoln did, he's being optimistic and saying, we can do it. We can repair the damage. And not only that, but we can evolve. Democracy itself can evolve, and it can renew itself. So these are his insights and his forecasts. He begins by criticizing the country, the hollowness, what he calls the hollowness and hypocrisy of democracy in the country at the current time. And he says people are cynical. They've lost their belief. But he does not despair, because he spells out what he thinks is needed to fix it. And only one thing can fix it. Just as Thoreau pointed out, it has to be the full development of the individual. Now, this doesn't mean, and by that, he didn't mean, okay, everybody should have a chance to make $1 million. One of the important ideas in this essay is that democracy itself was evolving and had what he called three stages. And he said the first stage was when the founders set up these principles, these sort of natural principles, as they thought, of government, a government that could basically fix itself through the checks and balances, that it had a way. They weren't setting up just some pattern that was set in stone for all time. They were setting up a government that had a process to it that could actually correct itself over time, just like a living system has that feedback mechanism in it. And Whitman liked this idea also, and he said, okay, that was stage one, that we set up the mechanism whereby the government could evolve. The second stage is the economic stage, and he felt in his day that's what people were going for, was this kind of economic abundance. Everybody had, and he thought that was fine, that was good. We do need to have material abundance, and every person should have that ability to make themselves comfortable. But that's not where it stops, and where a lot of people feel democracy stops. It's just a chance to, everybody should have a chance to be physically comfortable. No, that's not enough, says Whitman. He said the third stage, and the one he hoped that America would be entering into in 1871, was the spiritual stage, but he called it religious democracy. And by that, he did not mean particularly any one religion. He meant a democracy that was connected to the divine. In other words, to the divine laws of nature, as will come out in the excerpts I'm going to read now. There is, he says, that something a man is, standing apart from all else, divine in his own right, and a woman in hers, sole and untouchable by any canons of authority or any rule derived from precedent, state safety, the acts of legislatures. Underneath the fluctuations of the expressions of society, we see, steadily pressing ahead and strengthening itself, this image of the completeness of a single person. The purpose of democracy is, through many transmigrations, to illustrate at all hazards this theory that man, properly trained in sanest, highest freedom, must become a law unto himself. And what he means here is, a law unto himself doesn't mean just doing anything we like, but rather perfect self-referral, as he goes on to explain. I say the mission of government is not repression alone, but higher than the highest arbitrary rule, to train communities through all their grades, beginning with individuals and ending there again, to rule themselves. The purpose is not altogether direct, perhaps it is more indirect. For it is not that democracy is of exhaustive account in itself. Perhaps, indeed, it is like nature, of no account itself. And by that he means not for itself alone, but it is the tool of evolution. Democracy, too, is law, and of the strictest, amplest kind. Many suppose democracy means a throwing aside of law and running riot. Law is the unshakable order of the universe forever. Would you have in yourself the divine, vast, general law? Then merge yourself in it. The liberalist of today seeks not only to individualize, but to universalize. And then he goes on in this really amazing passage to describe an experience of the individual merging with universal law. Only in the perfect uncontamination and solitariness of individuality may the spirituality of religion positively come forth at all. Let me say that one again. Only in the perfect uncontamination and solitariness of individuality may the spirituality of religion positively come forth at all. Only here and on such terms the meditation, the devout ecstasy, the soaring flight. Only here alone an identity and the mood and the soul emerges, and all statements, churches, sermons melt away like vapors. Alone, and silent thought and awe and aspiration. And then the interior consciousness, like a hitherto unseen inscription in magic ink, beams out its wondrous lines to the sense. Bibles may convey, and priests expound. But it is exclusively for the noiseless operation of one's isolated self to enter the pure ether of veneration, reach the divine levels, and commune with the unutterable. Maybe I'll read part of that again, because it's very poetic. He's trying here not to be rational, but to inspire through an intuitive poetic statement of what an experience of self-referral is like. Alone, and identity and the mood, and the soul emerges, and all statements, churches, sermons melt away like vapors. Alone, and silent thought and awe and aspiration, and then the interior consciousness, like a hitherto unseen inscription in magic ink, beams out its wondrous lines to the sense. Now that, to me, almost sounds like he's saying that there's this invisible constitution within our own consciousness, almost like the way Maharshi describes Ved is that invisible text that's like invisible ink, you know, and it suddenly floods forth when we're on that level. Bibles may convey and priests expound, but it is exclusively for the noiseless operation of one's isolated self, with a capital S, to enter the pure ether of veneration, reach the divine levels, and commune with the unutterable. And we know that Whitman did have experiences of transcending, which he described throughout his poetry. So again, this is his experience of self-referral, or description of it, where consciousness consults its own unbounded nature. And so this is the individual immersing in universal law. And that's where Whitman would like to see a person able to go to that divine level, and from there develop in tune with the evolution of everything. Now, the other interesting thing about this essay, it's also the one where Whitman becomes a visionary and predicts that the capital of the U.S. will move to the middle of the country. Quote, "In a few years, the Dominion heart of America will be far inland toward the west. Our future national capital may not be where the present one is. It is possible that in less than 50 years it will migrate 1,000 or 2 miles, will be refounded, and everything belonging to it made on a different plan, original, far more superb. The main social political spine character of the states will probably run along the Ohio, Missouri, and Mississippi rivers." This was quite an auspicious and far-sighted pronouncement in light of the peace government being inaugurated in Washington, D.C., and in Maharshi Vedic City, Iowa, located between the Missouri and the Mississippi. Maharshi says the peace government is a natural phenomenon. It derives its authority from total natural law, found, as Whitman discovered, in everyone's own divine consciousness. And this, I thought also that Whitman's wording of this prediction of the refounding of America is really in line with what's happened so often through American history. There have been moments when people like Lincoln and people like Emerson and Whitman declared a refounding of America, that we need to go back to our roots, we need to refresh ourselves, to renew our original vision. This is also part of the American dream, this idea of constantly renewing ourselves, going back to our national self and refounding America. So I thought that the peace government was such a moment when we are saying, yes, we want to go back to that original vision of self-referral in the American government, embedded in the American Constitution itself, and enliven that. So Maharshi also makes the distinction between the man-made constitution of a country and the constitution of the universe, as Thoreau and Whitman have done. Why rely solely on the external and less flexible constitution? Lincoln said in his first inaugural address, quote, "No foresight can anticipate, nor any document of reasonable length contain express provisions for all possible questions, unquote. Then where is the Constitution that is subtle enough to provide for all possible situations? The idea of the constitution of the universe within the human mind was well known to 19th century writers. Coleridge, Wordsworth, Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, and many others refer to it as the basis of human poetry as well as human justice. And they often use that exact phrase, the constitution of the universe. Maharshi now adds a scientific confirmation. Quote, fortunately, the constitution of the universe, the constitution of natural law, has been discovered within the physiology of everyone, within the intelligence of every grain of creation, and within the ever-expanding universe as a whole. That's from Perfection in Administration. The enlightened scientist, His Majesty King Nataram, in his book Human Physiology, The Expression of Veda in the Vedic Literature, says, quote, the exact correspondence between the structure and function of the human physiology and the structure and function of Veda gives us great confidence that the knowledge of the most fundamental level of natural law is now fully available to mankind. The total potential of natural law on the self-referral level of individual intelligence is fully enlivened by the attention of the conscious mind through the applied technology of Maharshi Vedic science. The individual is cosmic, as Whitman plainly says. He advises us to merge ourselves in cosmic law. And this is exactly what meditation does, takes us to the level of the constitution of the universe within us. Large groups of yogic flyers are an even more powerful tool for stimulating the justice of nature within us to flow out to the land. And when Vedic pundits recite Rig Ved, enlivening the primordial sounds of the universal constitution of everyone, of every country, then we have a global country of world peace, a Ram Raj for the whole earth. The self-referral power of nature is in us, and it's now being accessed to create on a permanent basis the complementary government of natural law that Americans have always dreamed of and spoken of. Emerson said, quote, the true test of civilization is not the census, nor the size of the cities, nor the crops, no, but the kind of man the country turns out. Now, that is the wisdom of a man to hitch his wagon to a star and see his chore done by the gods themselves. The evolution of a highly destined society must be moral. It must run in the grooves of the celestial wheels. That's from his essay, Civilization. All right, so it's been clearly set out by our own writers what a successful civilization would be. And our own writers also point out how many times we have not lived up to that. And so this peace government, I find quite exciting and inspiring, because it is not only once again announcing, yes, we want to renew our vision of government, it's actually doing it. It's actually finding a way through this technology whereby people can turn inward to the government of nature and enliven the government of nature in a very effortless way. We don't even need to think about it. It's easy to do, and it doesn't disrupt or have anything to do with the surface machinery of government. It's very, as we read that beautiful description by Whitman, it's very internal. It's just turning to that level of government within and then enlivening that in the collective consciousness. And that's what this peace government will do. Very automatically, and nobody even needs to think about it that much. But this beautiful quote by Emerson, that the civilization must run in the grooves of the celestial wheels, reminds us of Maharshi saying, Brahm, or the totality of natural law, is the charioteer. So that's what the peace government is, and it will be creating beautiful waves of change for us. And so this is a wonderful time. On July 4th, we are really proud of Maharshi's birthday gift to the country, a peace government, fulfilling the American dream of perfect government. And for a birthday wish, we wish for the United States perfect government and perfect citizens. And I thought it would be wonderful to end the program with this Navajo prayer. May my body be light, may my body be cool, may my feet be strong, may my legs be sturdy, may my body be whole, may my mind be clear. Surely this day happily I get up, all has returned to normal. May it be beautiful before me, may it be beautiful behind me, may it be beautiful under me, may it be beautiful above me, may it be beautiful all around me. May my speech be controlled. Restoration to youth according to beauty I have become, I say. May all these things be so. Jay Gurudev.
That's so beautiful, Susan. I was really taken with Walt Whitman's comment, man has the ability to be a law unto himself. And only in the uncontaminated solitariness of individuality may the spirituality of religion positively come forth. That's a huge, huge thing. It really is. But Maharshi's been saying this all along, has he not? And just in transcending.
Yes, it's interesting. Many people have been saying things like that for many, many years. If you look at world literature, you can find incredible statements like that in artists, philosophers, and even in some wise statesmen. Of course, we realize the situation is how to implement all of these wise sayings that have been pronounced forever, and I think that's why we are so grateful for this technology. What can we say? It's the fulfillment of science. In fact, the U.S., many people have pointed out, is the first science-based, supposedly the first science-based government in the world. It was begun during the time when the thinkers were really looking towards the scientific angle. That is, life should be able to be improved through human knowledge and effort. We don't have to just sit around and wait and hope that we'll get God's grace. We can do something. We can be partners in that. That was the scientific revolution. Very noble ideals. And founding a nation on those principles was amazing. And it has inspired the whole world for three centuries. But we needed to, as Whitman pointed out, you know, there are stages in the development of democracy, and we need to take it another step. That is, how do we do what Jefferson said and what Whitman said and Thoreau said, fully develop the individual? Well, we have a further refinement of science and technology, which allows us to actually implement these changes that we're talking about. That is, how can the individual tap into nature's government, imbibe that, and then radiate that to the whole society? There is a technology for that, and Maharshi has given it to us with the blessings of the Vedic tradition. It's been around for as long as the universe has. It's not a new knowledge. But we're just lucky that now it is available in a form that people can take advantage of. And so it's going to happen. And the prediction that Whitman made is actually happening. One, that democracy was evolving. And the second one had to do with the center of the country, that this center of the country can be a complementary government, or any place actually where there's a group of people practicing this technology. It doesn't have to be here, but there is one here. And we feel very fortunate that we could actually fulfill the predictions that have been made for a long time. And so it's a very fulfilling time for this country.
Yes, we are very thankful for Maharishi and the Transcendental Meditation Technique and the Siddhis program that will really bring to fruition these marvelous ideas about perfect government. And Dr. Anderson, we want to thank you very much for bringing out the principles of government through natural law and using the Constitution of the Universe as chronicalized by some of the best literary minds throughout American history and its correlation with Maharishi's peace government. So as Maharishi says, there's nothing new under the sun. Let's just go on to the next step.
Thanks, Stan. And I think we'll close with this inspiring piece of music by Werner Elmker. I heard on his show a couple of weeks ago, The Classical Music Guide, this theme, and I thought, oh, this is perfect for this show. It's piano variations on My Country 'Tis of Thee from his album Sweet Dreams for Children. I think that the variations are just brilliant, and it brings out a very deep sentiment and a love for this country that all of these writers, even if they were maybe criticizing on some level, they were doing it because their hearts were so full. They loved this country so much. And I think this music brings out that love of country. So let's end with My Country 'Tis of Thee. Thank you.